Hi, this is Tom Salami of Device Talks. Welcome to the Intuitive Talks podcast. Surgical robotics presents an enormous opportunity for companies. There are surgeon shortages, sporadic healthcare, and miraculous technological advancement in both robotics and communications. So to understand where this sector is headed, we invited senior executives from Intuitive to share their company's impressive story. Change is coming. Consider these upcoming episodes to be guideposts for the future to follow. Hey everyone, this is Tom Salami of Device Talks. Welcome back to the Intuitive Talks podcast. This is a very special episode, specially timed. The interview I did with Brian Miller, he's Executive Vice President and Chief Digital Officer at Intuitive, I did back in the summer. I was able to go down to Intuitive's Atlanta headquarters. And not only did I have a sit down with Brian Miller, but I was also able to actually give DaVinci 5 a test ride and use its telesurgery capabilities. I was able to do a little bit of a procedure with Dr. Miriam Curette, who's the CMO, the Chief Medical Officer. She was in Sunnyvale. I was in Atlanta, and it was a really fascinating experience. I felt as if I was getting punked that she was maybe in the same room behind a curtain. Because we felt that close. It was really a remarkable experience. And we're hoping to bring you more of that experience in the future, working on a project with Intuitive. But I wanted to get this conversation out with Brian Miller out before then, because we'll be talking at Device Talks West a lot about surgical robotics, of course, but specifically about telesurgery. Brian Miller will be on a very, very excellent panel. That will be taking place on day two. That's October 16th. The event is October 15th and 16th. And the panel is called Telesurgery's Turning Point. It takes place at 2:30 on October 16th. Telesurgery's Turning Point, Unlocking the Future of Remote Robotic Surgery. And Brian will be on a panel along with Shane Farador, who's the co-founder and chief technical officer at Virtual Incision, in Yulon Wong from Savato, amongst others. So it's going to be a deep dive into the potential for telesurgery. And we've seen a lot of excitement about that, a lot of news coming out of SRS this year, a lot of demonstrations by surgical robotics companies. And the conversation I had with Brian, and the one you'll hear today, is cautionary is too strong, but I think it really demonstrates Intuitive's approaching this as a medical device company would. And Brian asked some good questions, I think, about the ability of the healthcare system to handle telesurgeries, to manage them, to have all the infrastructure they need to have in place. And his overriding message is, let's make sure, you know, this is a clinical need. And clearly, arguments could be made for it being a clinical need, but let's make sure there's a clinical need. And let's make sure that the safeguards are in place to ensure that patients are protected. So Brian has some experience with telesurgery, as we'll get into in the conversation. And of course, he's a chief driver at Intuitive. So his words carry a lot of weight. And we'll unpack that larger issue and talk a lot about some of the technical challenges around telesurgery. And also just talk a little bit about DaVinci 5's capabilities in this area. So I hope you'll enjoy this. I know you'll enjoy this conversation with Brian Miller, and I hope you'll join us at Device Talks West for not only this panel, but for the entire 2 days, October 15th and 16th, at the Santa Clara Convention Center. If you want to attend and want a discount, you can use our podcast code DTWeekly25 to save 25%. If you have any questions about the event, feel free to shoot me an email. But I hope you'll join us there on the October 15th and 16th, again, at the Santa Clara Convention Center. And one other group that will be there is one of our favorite sponsors, Blue Goat Cyber. Blue Goat happens to be the sponsor of today's Intuitive Talks podcast. And now I'm going to hand the microphone over to Device Talks Managing Editor Kayleen Brown, as she has a conversation with Christian Espinosa the CEO and founder of Blue Goat.
Christian Espinoza, founder and CEO of Blue Goat Cyber, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks for having me on, Kayleen. Appreciate it.
So, Christian, I love sitting down with a fellow podcast host. You're the host of the Med Device Cyber podcast, and I will drop a link in the show notes so that our audience can get connected with your podcast, and it's a really terrific one. I'd be really surprised, Christian, if our audience is not already aware of Blue Goat Cyber, but just in case they aren't, would you mind telling us a little bit more about Blue Goat Cyber?
Sure. Blue Goat Cyber focuses on medical device cybersecurity. So we help medical device manufacturers with all the pre-market documentation, all the testing, all the analysis, all the risk assessment in order to get their device cleared by the FDA of the United States. We do EU MDR and other regulatory authorities around the world, but we do all the pre-market guidance and all the work for pre-market submission. And then we also do post-market management. So we help a manufacturer get the device cleared. And once it's cleared, we have an annual contract where we monitor the device for new threats and new vulnerabilities and attack profiles that may change as well.
If you could walk through the process of how you work with medical device companies, I think that'd be really helpful.
There's three main ways we work with a medical device manufacturer, and this is really where they are in their development cycle or funding cycle to typically tie together. The first is we have a secure medtech design consulting service. This is where a manufacturer, if they're in Series A funding typically, and they're developing the product or trying to iron out the requirements, we will help them design cybersecurity into the device. Because all the regulatory authorities require what's called a secure product development framework. They want security designed into the device, not bolted on at the end. So we help them with those design decisions because we realize most software developers are worried about functionality, and we help infuse that cybersecurity lens into the development process. That's the first part. Later on, typically 6 months is kind of the sweet spot before a submission for, let's say, a 510K in the United States with the FDA. We work with a manufacturer to do all the documentation, all the testing, and all the analysis so we can work with whoever's submitting their package and provide them everything required for the cybersecurity requirements by the FDA. Once the device is cleared, and we guarantee our clearance as well, we work with the manufacturer and guarantee our work. So if there's any additional information request or a deficiency letter, we've never received one of those, we will make sure we address that. And then once the device is on the market or it's cleared, we then do post-market management. That's an annual contract where we look for new vulnerabilities. We set up a vulnerability disclosure portal where somebody can log a vulnerability if they discover it. We do triage. If there is a vulnerability reported, we run it to ground to make sure it's a true positive versus a false positive. And we work with the manufacturer to help update the device and keep it secure. So basically, we look at the full product lifecycle from the inception until disposal, and we can work in any of those areas.
We're going to hear more from our sponsor, Blue Goat Cyber, a little later on in the podcast. But if you can't wait to learn more, please visit their website at bluegoatcyber.com. And now we bring you our keynote interview with Brian Miller, Executive Vice President and Chief Digital Officer for Intuitive.
Well, Brian Miller, thanks for having us at Intuitive's very impressive, I want to say headquarters, but how are we defining this space in Atlanta? Is this your East Coast headquarters?
Yeah, it's our East Coast hub. Mm-hmm. We have manufacturing here. We've got a lot of the engineering and enterprise teams here, so yeah, it's a good campus for us.
That's great. So I just got a demo of DV5. I got to use it for the first time, which was very exciting. I think I'm ready to change careers now and go and become a surgeon. I probably need some more schooling before I do that. But the reason we're here primarily, I think, is to talk about the move that we're seeing into telesurgery. Mm-hmm. We're seeing news of demonstrations. We're seeing news of cases that have been done. Mm-hmm. And I feel like it's really gone from even last year. We were talking about being at SRS last year, and I know you'll be there this year. I feel like this past year, things have just accelerated at a great clip. How just broadly, and we'll get into some details, but how broadly, how do you view
the opportunities in telesurgery?
Yeah, so I think there's opportunity in being able to connect remote individuals to collaborate in surgery. And that's been an important aspect for us for a while. Mm-hmm. We've invested in telepresence, which is audio, video, and visuals. But I think there's opportunity. If you look back to where it started in 2001, technology building blocks are there. And so I think as you start to evolve it, there's some other things that we'll probably get into that if you're going to drive it from demonstration to routine use, there's things beyond the technology that need to be addressed, but there is a good momentum.
Well, let's get into those things. But you were at the Lindbergh operation.
I was a young engineer.
What was that, seeing that happen? What was that like?
It really was exciting. Yeah. I mean, at the time when I started, just in general, bringing together technology with surgery, which didn't have a lot of technology applied to it, mm-hmm. Over the years was exciting. It's what attracted to me to this field. But seeing the ability to project expertise across distance was exciting.
Did you at the time think that we're here, we've planted this flag 10 years from now, this will be routine, 20 years from now, it'll be standard? Yeah. What was your feeling back then?
Yeah, it's hard to tell. I think what it did in 2001 is it demonstrated that it was possible, mm-hmm. right? But there's a number of things that I think would have to occur. And for Intuitive, we're always looking at how can we get things into routine use that has the biggest impact on patients and improving patient care. And so at the time, for example, the telecom lines, it was the technology was there, but the access to telecom lines wasn't broadly.
Of course.
Look over the years and you can start to see that it reaches more places. Then you started to look at some of the other aspects of the robotic system. At that point in time, it wasn't a proven technology to deliver better outcomes. It was in its infancy. And so there was a body of work over the past 25 plus years that really showed that robotics could deliver better care. Mm-hmm. So now you dovetail technology advancement with proven robotics and you're where we're at today.
That seems to be a natural progression. Get your beachhead, prove yourself, and then move forward. So where are we today with those technical challenges? What do we have available to us that will make telesurgery possible and beneficial? And then maybe we can follow up with what bridges we still need to cross.
Yeah. Well, I'll answer that by kind of going back to how innovation occurs, because mm-hmm. I think it's important to start with what are the valuable use cases. So what guides us is really understanding what problems we can solve or what we can provide to surgeons that will improve patient care. Mm-hmm. So you start with that, it's your guiding principle. Then you can start to say, okay, what technologies and what things are there. And so as you start to go through and design prototypes like we're going to see today, and you start iterating on, are we delivering a product that's actually meeting the customer's needs? That's when you start to go, okay, I've got the technology right, and I've got the specifications right. And so that's the journey we're on right now. And so when you go in, as I said, some of the base technologies around networks, latency, we can talk a little bit about that. Mm-hmm. Those things are solvable problems. But if you step back and say, what is required for routine use? There's a range of user interface technologies that need to be developed. So there are things that need to be created so that you can create that great experience for a surgeon and effective collaboration across distance.
So let's talk about latency right now. Are we at the point where it can be accounted for? First, step back, give us an understanding of what latency is.
Yeah.
What have been the technical challenges that have kept us from made that an insurmountable problem, and how have we overcome it?
Yeah. So I first will define really what is important on latency, and it's what impacts that surgeon experience. So we refer to it as kind of hand-to-eye latency, mm-hmm. and so it is when the surgeon moves the controller to initiate a movement of the instrument, and then ultimately when they see that movement of the instrument inside the viewer. So that end-to-end is what matters for latency, because it's what the surgeon experiences. So there's different components of that. So if you just kind of go through the chain, you've got the robotic system, which will acquire the signal of, I want to move the instrument. Mm-hmm. That is then sent across the telecom line. The robot receives it, unpacks it, moves the instrument. The endoscope then captures the image and then sends it back across the telecom line so that the remote surgeon can see it. So all those add up for that hand-to-eye latency. And so when you start to look at the telecom link of that, which is often what we hear in the news, they'll talk about milliseconds worth of data. A lot of those are in kind of the transport latency from the network. And mm-hmm. so that's evolved over time. And there are latencies. I mean, it's governed by the speed of light, but there are latencies that are sufficient for the telecom technology that we have. Then there is the robot design that you need to make sure that the additional latency going through the system is manageable, so that overall effective latency. So it is a solvable problem from technology. I think there we've got solutions, and you'll see one today that provides the right performance that is needed for the use cases we care about.
And what's the measurement for the time? What is the maximum amount of time between my moving my hand and seeing the robot move?
Yeah, it depends upon distance. Yeah. So if you look at the telecom line, the transport latency will vary based on distance. And then it also depends upon, for the robotic system, are you sending only 2D video, which isn't as enabling, but you can send it quicker, or you sending the 3D vision, which is more information. So there are design trade-offs you can make to manage that latency. And I also think it's applied, the amount of latency that you can manage also applies to the use case that you're trying to enable. Mm-hmm. And we can talk about the different use cases that we think are important. There's not a magic number, but we have started to drive a set of best practices through some guidance where you can kind of say, hey, human interaction means that for them to be able to effectively complete a task, these are the types of latencies that are acceptable.
We're going to take a really quick break from our conversation with Intuitive's Brian Miller to bring you the conclusion of my interview with Christian Espinoza, founder and CEO of Blue Goat Cyber. So what type of companies do you work with? I mean, is there a specific range or company size?
We have a portfolio, I would say, of 60 to 70% of startups, and they're going through rounds of funding. So we typically work with them in Series A or Series B funding. And then the other 30% or so of our portfolio are large companies that have a suite of products. These are often publicly traded companies that have a line of products, like in the vitro diagnostic space, for instance. And we work with them on all of their products for the pre-market as well as the post-market.
Let's shift to what's to come. Are there any new products that you're able to discuss with us coming out of Blue Goat Cyber?
We are a service provider, but we do have a product that we are testing still in order to enhance our service offering. Right now, we're calling it a collaboration portal. But what it does, it allows us to collaborate with our clients on the documentation creation. They can make comments. They can upload documents. They can see visibility into where we are with each document that's required for the submission. And one of the things that people have asked us about before is where we are with each document from a percentage completion wise. So this dashboard has percentages per document and percentage overall for the entire project. So it gives complete transparency and visibility for a client to know exactly where we are in the process.
Transparency and communication is everything when it comes to relationships, especially in medtech. So that's very encouraging. Let's talk about the future. Artificial intelligence coming in, data, this is all, I think, your area of expertise. So how do you see cybersecurity changing in the future?
I think it is just now coming to people's minds. I think in like pharma, cybersecurity has been a big concern for a while, but then in medtech, as an example, the FDA just finalized their cybersecurity guidance in June of 2025.
Didn't realize that.
Yeah, it's been in draft since 2023. But we've had a couple cases come up that have really illuminated some of the concerns about cybersecurity. One is the Illumina case, where they sort of swept a few cybersecurity vulnerabilities under the rug and got it approved, and then a whistleblower exposed that. That's kind of raised a lot of eyebrows about this. And then as far as AI and the trends with AI, I kind of think we're too premature to really roll out AI. There's a case that's going on right now where there's a wellness application that is doing therapy for a patient. This patient was suicidal. And the wellness app that used AI, after a couple months, told the patient, well, you might as well go ahead and kill yourself. And the patient did kill themselves. So
wow.
We rarely look at what happens when AI gets it wrong, but the consequences can be dire, as in that case. So I think, you know, there's a cybersecurity component to AI, but there's also just the maturity of AI in this industry. And I think we need to take it very seriously.
Very well said. And thank you for bringing that awareness to our audience. And with that, Christian Espinoza, founder and CEO of Blue Goat Cyber, thank you so much for joining us on the podcast. And for our audience, if you want to learn how you can work with Blue Goat Cyber, please visit their website at bluegoatcyber.com. That's BlueGoatCyber.com. And now the conclusion of our interview with Brian Miller, Executive Vice President and Chief Digital Officer for Intuitive. Enjoy.
Let's dive into the user cases. What are some of the user cases that you see this?
Yeah, so we kind of separate them into two categories. The first one is more collaborative surgery. So the configuration that that we have prototyped and are pursuing is our dual console configuration. So we have that today in our in-room. So you have two consoles, you have the patient side cart and you have the vision cart. This configuration, you just take one console and put it in a remote location. Mm-hmm. So there you've got two surgeons that are collaborating for either a training situation where a more experienced surgeon is helping to drive best practices and technique improvement to another surgeon, or you could have two different specialties that are collaborating together to perform a procedure on a patient. I think the aspect there is you have a surgeon in the operating room that is responsible for the patient. Mm-hmm. Then you have another category of procedures where the remote surgeon is the one performing the procedure, which is what we've heard a lot about in some of the events that have been done. Mm-hmm. And I think the technology is very similar to enable that, you know, with regard to the robotic system and the networks. But you have a different set of challenges beyond the technology that you have to address, such as what is the hospital safety protocol? If you've got a remote surgeon that can't physically get into the operating room during a procedure. So. Mm-hmm. But those are really the two categories. It's probably more detailed use cases when you get to training versus collaborative surgery. But I think those are the categories. And like all technology, once you start to bring it into the market, there will be use cases that emerge that customers see value that we would look to pursue.
So let's talk about the collaborative cases first off. Where are we today with being able to collaborate, have two surgeons collaborate, one remotely? It would seem that that would be something, I mean, if there's a surgeon in the room, there's a team in the room, having that additional surgeon outside the room assisting would seem to be something that's feasible today.
Yeah, so let me position it into kind of the continuum of telecollaboration. Mm-hmm. So, and we believe this continuum will persist even when you have the ability to remotely control instruments. And so today we have telepresence, which allows one surgeon remote and one in the operating room to see the same surgical view. They can communicate, you can point to things. So there's a level of guidance and mentoring that can be provided with technology today. So you can imagine with telesurgery capability, so the ability now not only to see, hear, and point, but the ability to control instruments or control the camera for the field of view is a natural extension to that collaboration. And so we have capabilities today, and then as this technology goes through its development pathway, then we will enable more capabilities as far as interacting. So that continuum makes sense, and even when telesurgery is there, you may have situations where a surgeon just needs a quick second opinion. Mm-hmm. They don't need to go in and control instruments, they just need to see the video. And then there will be other situations where being able to sit down and together collaborate during the procedure, each at a console, will be valuable. So that's what we're looking to enable.
And what is the timeline for allowing that to happen, users of the Da Vinci 5 to be able to perform this?
So not going to talk about timelines. I think there is a...
Understood.
But I do think, though, the pathway mm-hmm. is important. We're extremely excited to show you where the technology is at. Mm-hmm. It is a capable. It brings all of the capabilities that we believe are important to robotics and makes them available remotely. And so we're excited there. It will continue to go through its iterations. Mm-hmm. You know, we work closely with customers to make sure that as we're iterating on the design. They come in, they test it out, they provide feedback. That's how we have found to be effective to back into a product that meets customer needs and ultimately is good. Then when it's ready, and we'll start our go-to-market efforts.
Does the system that allows for that sort of collaboration and for the telesurgery, Is it a different system than the DV5? Is there an add-on, more applications added to the DV5? What has to happen for, no timelines, but the day you get approval, what needs to change the DV5 to make it possible?
Yeah, so DV5 was built to be extensible and have the compute necessary. Mm-hmm. And so you probably heard us talk about the 10,000 times compute that DV5 brings. It was built to enable these types of capabilities. Mm-hmm. So now you need to look at what is necessary from the telecom perspective and make sure that you're looking at the whole system. But from a DaVinci 5, it has the necessary compute and capabilities to enable it.
Okay. So looking at the other type of use, having the surgeon in one geography and the patient in the other, where are we in having that be possible? And what are the hurdles that stand in the way for us to be able to, for you to be able to do that?
Yeah, so I'll first start with the technology. And from a technology perspective of, can somebody in a remote location control the instruments, do what they need to do, that is a common set of capabilities as the collaborative surgery. So that's there. I do think there's an aspect that we call situational awareness. But when you have somebody in a remote location, unlike when they were in the operating room, they could pick up their head, they could look at the rest of the room, the OR staff. That's something that is, they can't just pick up their head when they're in a remote location. Mm-hmm. So we're spending a lot of time really understanding what information does that remote surgeon need to be effective in doing the procedure. And I think there's some work there to really understand it when you don't have another surgeon in the operating room with you that you can ask and do those types of things. So I think there's some work there in what we call situational awareness, which could be user interface, it could be what views do you need of the operating room, things of that nature. But those are solvable problems. Then you come down and you start to look at all of the things that are outside of the technology. And you start to look at licensing, training, start to look at the regulatory pathway for that use case, right? Regulatory clearance is not about a technology, it's about a use case in your application. And so that is, those are things where, those are not questions that have been answered. And they're definitely not questions that have been answered at to make it routine use and to do it at scale. And so, what are the economics around it?
Mm-hmm.
So having the telecom link in between is going to add cost to a procedure. Need to really make sure that the use cases add value such that it makes sense and it can be a durable solution.
So when you hear of the cases being done and being talked about in headlines, do you have any concerns that sort of we're putting the cart before the horse a bit or perhaps setting expectations higher than maybe they should be at this point?
I really can't comment on just what they're what those companies are thinking and how they're going about doing it, and so I just I'm not in a position to be able to determine that. I do think though, when you look at what is the industry need, it is really understanding the use cases, the value, and then what are all of the obstacles you need to knock down to enable that use case. And so I think that's where the focus needs to be. Then at that point in time, you can start to say, okay, are there any technology gaps? Where are the policy gaps and regulatory gaps? And so I think that's where we're stepping back and saying, all right, what is important is not to be first to market. Mm-hmm. What's important is to make sure that when we get there, it's done right. It's safe, it satisfies the customer needs. It's similar to all the innovation that we've been doing for the past 30 years.
Looking forward 10 or 20 years, how big a part is telesurgery in surgical robotics future? Intuitive obviously being part of that, but is it going to be a pillar of the use of surgical robotics? Is it going to be just a sometimes used feature for surgical robotics to realize its full potential? Does telesurgery have to be a big part of that future?
It's a really good question. I think as we go go down this journey, we will see what use cases it will enable. You know, I can say that there is, even though there's been a lot of advancements in telecom, there's been a lot of advancements in some of the technology enables it, there is still a large portion of the world where it's challenging, mm-hmm. right? And so when you do a case into an underserved part of the world, you still need very skilled individuals in the operating room. You still need infrastructure that can support the telecom mm-hmm. communication. So I think when you need to kind of pave the roads, you know, it's kind of like the EV analogy of EV cars. Well, part of the problem was the ability to have the infrastructure so that you could charge. There is still work to be done there. And so I can see care as it is today, robotically still providing all of the benefit around the dexterity, the precision, the advanced imaging, things that we can do continuing to go. But we do believe that telesurgery will fit into this telecollaboration continuum and will be enabling. But we'll see how the use cases evolve, and I'll be just as excited to see what it looks like in 10 years as well.
Great. Well, excellent thoughts. Thanks, Brian Miller, for giving us this glimpse inside.
Well, that is a wrap. Thanks so much for joining us on this episode of the Intuitive Talks podcast. Thanks to our sponsor, Blue Goat. And to Christian Espinoza for joining us. Hope you'll see us all. Come see us all at Device Talks West. Once again, we'll have a great conversation about telesurgery with Brian Miller of Intuitive, plus others. We'll also have a keynote conversation with Aman Jetty of Intuitive. She heads DaVinci 5's program. So lots going on. Anna Zdwa from Moon Surgical will be there. We'll have Tim Schmidt from Johnson & Johnson. Hopefully we'll get a little Ottava update. So there's lots to be seen, heard, and a lot of people to meet at Device Talks West. I hope you will join us on October 15th and 16th at the Santa Clara Convention Center. Use the code DTWeekly25 to save 25%. If you have any further questions, connect with me on LinkedIn. Of course, connect with Kayleen Brown as well. We'd love to have you follow Device Talks also, and just be part of Device Talks going forward. And make sure you subscribe to the Device Talks Podcast Network so you don't miss a future Device Talks podcast episode. All right, folks, cannot wait to continue this conversation in Santa Clara. I sincerely hope you'll join us there. Take care, everybody.